Progressive lawmakers and criminal justice advocates say it's long past time that New York overhauls its use of fines and fees. To that end, state senators held a recent hearing in Albany to solicit feedback on legislation that would change the way fines and fees are utilized, if at all, against New Yorkers convicted of violating the penal code or the state's vehicle and traffic laws, and also directs courts to assess an individual's ability to pay a fine before handing them out. Joining us to discuss this issue is the sponsor of the bill, as well as the co-chair of the recent hearing into the topic, State Senator Julia Salazar, a Brooklyn Democrat and chair of the Chamber's Committee on Crime Victims, Crime, and Correction. Welcome back to the show, Senator.
Thank you so much for having me, Dave.
So I want to get to the rationale for this bill in a second, but first, can you walk us through the practical implications if it became law? For example, what fines and fees would no longer be collected?
So what this bill is focused on is fees, surcharges, and fines that are applied in criminal court on defendants. There's a distinction between fees and surcharges, which the bill would eliminate entirely, and punitive fines, which vary based on circumstances when someone is convicted of a crime. Fees and surcharges were never intended under the law to be punitive. They actually were created to raise revenue and to recuperate costs in the court system. But in practice, they end up being punitive because often defendants in criminal court cannot afford to pay their fee or their surcharge in addition to a fine, which may be punitive and part of their sentence. As a result, they end up accumulating debt, can even be at risk eventually of being incarcerated or reincarcerated. So what this bill would do is eliminate the fees and surcharges. For example, the parole fee that a person has to pay every time they see their parole officer, fees that may be applied for them to participate in a program, whether an alternative to incarceration program or something that is required of them, like a drug treatment program, as well as a mandatory surcharges. Those are applied for every criminal offense that ranges from violations to felonies and more serious charges. These are the fees and surcharges we would want to eliminate entirely. There's also mandatory minimum fines, which are applied to convictions. Currently, under the current law, judges don't have discretion. So when it comes to mandatory minimum fines, you know, hence the term mandatory minimum, they have to set that amount regardless of an individual's ability to pay. The judge cannot even assess that. So what the bill would do is eliminate mandatory minimum fines, but would give judges discretion in situations where it's determined that an individual does have the resources to pay a fine or restitution to a crime victim, for example. They would still be able to set those fines. So that's what would remain under the bill if we were to pass it.
Are you comfortable giving judges the kind of wiggle room to determine a individual's ability to pay a fine? Because sometimes when left to their own devices, they have shown a tendency to continue to follow past practices, even if they have more options at their disposal.
Yeah, I mean, it's a serious concern when judges have discretion in setting bail, that at times, even when a defendant can demonstrate that they really cannot afford to pay any amount of bail, or they can only pay, let's say, $500, bail might be set exceedingly higher than that, which is counterintuitive and not what the law is intended to do. So I have that similar concern when it comes to mandatory fines. However, what we can do, and I think what we should do under the law, is require specifically that judges consider specific circumstances, right? And that they actually apply a clear formula to determining whether or not someone can afford to pay, rather than it being completely open-ended.
At your hearing and at a press conference prior to the hearing, you heard anecdotes about the negative consequences, potentially unintended consequences, that some of the fees and surcharges that are being levied now as essentially funding mechanisms have on countless New Yorkers. Can you highlight an anecdote that really resonated with you as being indicative of why your legislation needs to be adopted?
We heard from numerous individuals yesterday, both who had personally gone through the court system and been financially devastated by these fees and surcharges, as well as people who work in the court system. We heard from a former Albany police chief, Brendan Cox, who was testifying in support of the bill and said that it would actually make it easier for them to do their work, working with an alternative to incarceration program with other former law enforcement. But one of the things that really struck me the most was the burden that fines, fees, and surcharges places on Black women in particular, not only as individuals going through the court system, but also the burden that is placed on families, mothers, daughters, sisters, whose family members are going through the court system. Testimony that we heard included reports and studies that showed that the vast majority, more than 83% of people who are directly impacted, who are paying these fines, fees, and surcharges are Black women, that the burden really falls most heavily and disproportionately on them. So these fees and surcharges that are not supposed to be punitive in any way, even from the perspective of the court system, but also fines, which may be intended to be punitive, but really aren't serving their purpose when people cannot afford to pay them at all. They just end up sitting with this debt, and ultimately more money is used to attempt to collect the fines than would actually be generated by somebody paying the fine. That really was what struck me the most, that this is not only impacting people going through the court system, but it clearly is having a devastating impact on entire families and even on communities in some cases. It's the hidden impact of all of this.
In case you're just joining us, you're listening to the Capitol Press Room, and we're talking with State Senator Julia Salazar about her legislation that would overhaul the use of fines, fees, and surcharges in New York. And you mentioned that some of these fees and surcharges were originally created as a funding mechanism for courts and other judicial-related operations. If your bill did become law, what's the total price tag that this might have? How much revenue would be lost to these local courts and other judicial operations?
It's difficult to fully assess the fiscal impact for a couple reasons. One is that while the state is supposed to track revenue, or rather localities and jurisdictions across the state are supposed to report the revenue generated by fines, fees, and surcharges locally to the state, they don't really do that for the most part. So we do not have the Office of Court Administration doesn't have, the state does not have a full assessment of how much revenue is generated. We would approximate that it's about $110 million that the state collects annually from fees and surcharges, and that includes some general, it's mostly general fund revenue, some special revenue funds, and a small amount that goes to the Indigent Legal Services Fund, which provides representation for people who can't afford it in criminal court. It's important to note that that assessment of the revenue that's generated annually from fines, fees, and surcharges does not take into account the expenses that to the state, to localities on enforcement of fines, fees, and surcharges. When somebody truly can't afford to pay, there's no penalty that can make it so that they can suddenly come up with the money. If someone is cash poor, that's just the circumstances. And often a lot of money is spent on enforcement, even on incarcerating someone. We know that if someone is ultimately unable to pay their mandatory minimum fine for their conviction after they're incarcerated and they've finished their sentence. Later on, if they're unable to pay that fine, they can be imprisoned for up to 15 days. The cost of incarcerating someone in New York for up to 15 days is about $18,000 per person. That's what we would be spending in order to collect a $75 fee. And that happens pretty frequently, unfortunately. So really, some have said that there may even be a cost savings to the state and to localities from passing this legislation. So it is a little bit difficult to tell. We know that it wouldn't be an enormous fiscal impact. And what's remarkable is we heard testimony in support of the legislation yesterday from ILS, from the New York State Office of Indigent Legal Services. They said in their testimony that even though they would anticipate a fiscal impact that would directly affect their office, which really the state, we should be funding ILS fully instead of relying on fines that people can't afford to pay in order to fund them. But the testimony we heard yesterday is that ILS supports this legislation because they think that the benefits of it would outweigh the relatively minor fiscal impact, a small portion of their annual budget.
Well, thinking about the lost revenue, say, from the perspective of an upstate town that might be bringing in additional funds as a result of, say, their traffic collections, is there any thought of doing this legislation in 2022 in the context of the budget so that there could be a funding stream attached so that if there is determined to be a loss in revenue for some of these operations that previously collected funds from fees and surcharge, that they could be made whole in the process?
Definitely. As we take up the legislation in the new session, we are going to make sure that Senate Finance is looking at the impact, certainly as we go into the state budget. And I think it's perfectly reasonable that we would allocate what seems to be a pretty small amount of funding that would be needed in order to help any localities that are actually reliant on fees and surcharges in order to fund their court system or to fund local enforcement of things like traffic violations. And it is important to note that for punitive fines for something such as a traffic violation that are intended to deter harmful behavior, those would still exist. The only difference is that in some cases, the judge would be able to make the fine more reasonable and able for the person to pay. And, you know, another thing that we heard yesterday was that it's possible that those localities would actually see more revenue coming in from people being able to pay the fines. In other words, that when there's no discretion to lower the fine to something that's manageable that someone will actually pay, they don't pay the fine at all. But under this legislation, if someone were instead assigned a fine, spoke to the judge, and the judge says, okay, I've determined that you can afford to pay a $35 fine, for example, and the person pays it, then the locality actually received more revenue in that case than they would have if the person just couldn't afford to pay at all. So I think that we would see a minimum impact, and that any impact the state definitely has a responsibility to make up the gap for, because this just is not a sustainable way for us to continue to fund local and state courts.
What do you think of the principle of restitution more broadly in our criminal justice system? Do you think it should play a role in the way we hand out sentences or think about punishment in New York at this time?
Often there is not real restitution in cases where financial restitution is part of someone's sentence. We heard testimony yesterday from an individual who had been previously incarcerated for 10 years in New York State. And her original offense was arson. And as a result, And thankfully, no person was physically harmed. But of course, there was damage to someone's home and their property. And as a result, this individual is expected to pay $1 million in restitution, which that restitution is actually paid to the insurance company of the people who are the victims in this case, whose property was set on fire. So, in other words, the insurance company already compensated the people who were harmed in this case, and the low-income individual who already served 10 years in state prison has this debt hanging over her head probably for the rest of her life. It was determined that she can only afford to pay $75 per month toward this restitution, which means that, you know, it would take, I'm not great at math, but about 200 years probably for her to pay this off, or longer than that, certainly longer than she's going to live. And so in that case, restitution is not really serving its purpose. It is not actually compensating. None of the money is going to crime victims. And it is also added on in addition to the debt that this person already paid to society by serving a prison sentence. So while I think that restitution is actually, it can play an important role in restorative justice and in getting justice for victims of crimes, too often that just isn't the case. And there is no justification for assigning restitution when the criminal defendant is just never going to have the means to pay it.
What seemed to be the holdup for your bill during the 2021 session? I noticed it never moved in the committee process, getting held up in the Codes Committee without a vote.
Yeah, well, it was a new bill this past year. And I think going into the new session, I'm certainly hopeful. Senator Bailey has been very supportive. He co-chaired the hearing with me, and he's the chair of the Senate Codes Committee. And so I'm hopeful that we'll be able to move the bill quickly through the legislative process in the upcoming session.
At least as of now, I don't think he's a co-sponsor of the bill. Has he indicated any sort of reservations to you about the bill that has kept him from bringing it up for a vote in his committee?
He has not, and I know Senator Bailey, I won't try to speak for him, but yesterday he was very supportive of the legislation during the hearing, really thoughtfully considering it, and he hasn't indicated any reservations about the bill to me. I think as the Codes Chair, he generally is just really cautious about putting his name on and co-sponsoring legislation when it's going through his committee or it hasn't gone through committee yet. But I'm hopeful that we'll have Senator Bailey's support.
And finally, you took over the Committee on Crime Victims, Crime and Correction earlier this year when the incumbent chair was stripped of the role because he was facing domestic abuse charges. Those charges have since been dropped. Do you expect to remain chair of the committee in 2022?
As of now, I do. Every year, typically every new term, or when there are any vacancies, mm-hmm. In our conference of chairs of committees, the majority leader, you know, reassesses and reassigns committee roles, and so it's completely at the discretion of our majority leader. But I've really been honored to serve as the chair of the Corrections Committee, and I'm definitely determined to continue to serve in that role. I've been a very active chair even outside of the legislative session. A couple weeks ago, I visited a state correctional facility at Sing Sing, and we'll be making another prison visit next week. So regardless of how long I am the chair of the committee, I am deeply committed to these issues and really enjoy doing the work that I get to do as the chair.
Well, we've been speaking with State Senator Julia Salazar. She is a Brooklyn Democrat and the chair of the Committee on Crime Victims, Crime and Correction. Senator, thank you so much for making the time. I really appreciate it.
Likewise. Thank you, Dave.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
Join us again for Capitol Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.